Travel is great, but planning for travel can be time-consuming and difficult. That's where One Travel comes in. With One Travel, you'll find everything you need to book the perfect trip. Flights, hotels, cars, transportation, it's all right there. With One Travel, you can book online, via app, or even pick up the phone and talk to a travel advisor ready to help you make your selections. Visit onetravel.com/music or call 855-437-2154. Plan it, book it, live it. One Travel.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
Here we are, another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. And again, it's you and I. Our cohort, Smiles and Greg, are off doing other things. So we have an accident, and I queued one up today that's right in your backyard. Right? Even though the accident was not here in the United States, the report's got enough in it to make it interesting. And I will open it up for you.
Well, this is a somewhat new experience. We're actually doing a report from the Australian Transportation Safety Bureau, which is the equivalent of the NTSB in Australia. And a couple of things that attracted me to this was it was a completed report. It involved flight instruction in a 172 where the instructor and the student had some issues. And I thought, well, that's what I'm going through right now. So I can say something about some of the things in here from direct experience. Now, this was apparently someone who was a private primary flight training, not like myself, who already had the private license and going for an instrument. But the issues that are being discussed are common to anybody who would fly this type of aircraft, which, of course, is all over the world. And another thing about this is it clearly had some decision-making issues involved with it. And even though the person on the controls for most of the early part of the incident here was a student, this is falling on the shoulders of the flight instructor. So this is a issue, or event rather, where we can talk about procedures in a Cessna 172, decision-making by the student pilot, decision-making by the instructor pilot. And I'll just start with a brief discussion. By the way, this happened in February of 2024. We're doing this show in May of 2024. I can't recall the last time I saw an incident from the NTSB with a general aviation aircraft fully vetted and a final report out there within 3 months. Typically, you would wait a year or more to see a report. Now, that's not a knock on the NTSB. That's more of a question of the workload and the people who are assigned to do that. That said, a brief history of this. This was a student pilot and a flight instructor who were on a dual training flight from what's called Gold Coast Airport, which is on the east coast of Australia, north of Sydney. It was a Cessna 172, and they were doing some air work and had a bit of a cross-country And they were coming back. Now they're coming back to this airport, which has a fairly long runway, runway 32, the one they were planning on landing on, and a relatively short runway, runway 35, which they listed was, I believe, 532 meters. Now, full disclosure, I can't recall landing on a runway that short in my flying career. Runways I'm landing on regularly now are on the order of 2,500 feet at my home airport, which, if they had 1,000 feet less, I'm sure I can land on a regular basis. Should I have a stabilized approach, and should I have my procedures halfway, mastered so that I'm not going too high or too fast, I'm giving you a little bit of an advance warning as to what this one's about. Well, they're coming in for landing. They're about 1,000 feet high and a couple of miles away from the runway when air traffic control said, hey, instead of landing on the longer runway, I want you to land on a shorter runway. And can you do so with, you know, as much as expedite this approach, basically? So there's several things going on here. One, the student and the instructor have it in their minds that they're going to land on a particular runway. Everything is going fine until they're relatively close to the airport where they have a sudden change of runway. Again, not an unusual thing to happen. It can happen all the time. But the student was the one handling this. And in this moment, the student indicated to the flight instructor that they weren't comfortable with doing this. Flight instructor insisted that the student go ahead and do so. So I'll go through, skip some of the details, except to say that they did come in, lined up for the runway. They were going relatively fast. How fast was it? Well, let me tell you this. When I'm flying my 172, I like to cross the runway threshold, roughly 30 feet high, roughly 65 minutes. This aircraft was crossing that threshold at 100 feet altitude and about 90 knots. Now, I can tell you this from past experience. I'm that high and that fast, I'm not even thinking about it. I don't care if it's a three times the distance, a 5,000-foot runway. I'm going around because I want to have a consistent, steady approach procedure every time I land. And for me, that's too high and too fast. After the fact, the flight instructor, who had told the student, even though they're high and fast, I think we can make this runway, he was basing his judgment based on the longer runway, which apparently they both had a lot of experience on, not this considerably shorter runway. And I'm showing a graphic here for those of you watching the video version of this, where you clearly see the entire length of that shorter runway. Things are happening fairly quickly. They have a bounce landing. The instructor takes over, tries to put the aircraft on the runway, hits the brakes, locks up the brakes. They barrel through the intersecting runway. By the way, these two runways were intersecting. They were supposed to stop short of it, according to air traffic control instructions. They couldn't. They went past the intersection. And there was a taxiway that they were told that they were supposed to go out on if this were a normal landing. Air traffic control offered another taxiway, which had less of a sharp turn to it. Apparently, the flight instructor didn't hear that because the flight instructor still wanted to go on this other taxiway. In the process of doing so, pulling back on the yoke in order to get altitude to do an aborted landing, has a tail strike. There's a hangar in front of them. And there's a photograph, which again, I'm showing in the video. The aircraft barely misses this hangar. They go around and land. So luckily, the instructor pilot and the student survived this, no injuries. The airplane, of course, was damaged. And we are left with a lot of lessons. And John, you know, you haven't flown this model of 172, but you were a private pilot in a light aircraft, one that you told me earlier had a fairly low stall speed where a short runway wasn't a problem. But this is not that case. So what's your takeaway from how they got into the situation?
Well, you know, when I'm looking through what's written here, the first thing is just, student pilot wasn't happy with the instructions they had to make that turn. So right there and then, the instructor pilot should have been on his game. You know, he might, you know, being an instructor pilot sometimes can be very boring. But when a student says to you they're not comfortable doing something, that should immediately perk you right up. And his response was to go ahead and try it. Well, that would be a good response if he had really responded and was ready to take over at a moment's notice, not drifting further back of the airplane, you know, the old saying, flying from the rear seat of the airplane. Well, so he wasn't really being on his game. So right off the bat, you have a student pilot, inexperienced and anxious about a maneuver that he's instructed to do. And you have an instructor pilot who's supposed to be the safeguard of the flight. And he's sort of laid back. So it's getting off on a bad foot before they even begin to make the turn as requested by air traffic control. So first step, the instructor pilot is not at home. He's not doing his duties. Can't blame the student pilot at that point. It's the student pilot clearly indicated that they were not comfortable accomplishing the task that they were asked to. And then it goes on because now it's not clear how engaged he was as the airplane makes the turn and starts to come in for a landing, because clearly it's too high and clearly it's too fast. And at some point he should have said to the student, not at the last second, but earlier, that you're too high and too fast, go around and let the student call in and make a go around. So there's another opportunity lost by the instructor on preventing this problem. And then they run it to the ground. And when he finally takes it over, it was a tad too late. As it said, you know, he went up, he had a tail strike trying to recover it, and he was getting too close to some buildings, and he yet had to make some interesting inputs to get around the building and to climb out again. And then after that, it had its undivided attention, obviously, and he went in and made a good landing. But it's unfortunate that his attention wasn't so focused, you know, 2 or 3 minutes earlier.
And admittedly, there's like a lot of quick decision making being made by air traffic control to reroute the aircraft, by the student pilot to put his or her mind in a different space from the runway they expected from, you know, several minutes before to the one that's coming up within the next minute or two. The instructor, according to the report, the logic was there was like a 14 knot headwind, thought the student pilot could land on this runway. And by the way, the student pilot had landed on this runway one time before. They don't get into that one time before in the detail, but I suspect it was a time where the student pilot knew ahead of time this was likely the runway they're going to land in. Might have done some study on it, might have had a scenario in their head. Who knows? They might have even had a simulator either at their training facility or on their home computer to sort of do this beforehand. And I mentioned earlier it was about 1,600 feet. The runway was about 1,900 feet. Still shorter, personally, than any runway I've landed on with a Cessna 172, but long enough with a stabilized approach to do so. And speaking of which, air traffic control asked the aircraft to make best speed. And the instructor advised a student to reduce the throttle to idle, put the nose down a little bit, get the speed up higher. And the aircraft is going about 110 knots before they deployed the first set of flaps. Again, the stabilized approach, as I do in my Cessna, and I try to do it the same way every time, I'm, you know, if it's a straight in approach or one where I'm going on a downwind and turning on base, I'm putting it at a much lower speed than that by the time I lower my flaps. I'm like, you know, well below 100 knots when I lower those flaps. And by the time I lower the second set of flaps to 20 degrees, I'm down to maybe 80, 85. And then slowing down to 75 before I get the last notch of flaps, crossing the runway, like I said before, about 65 knots, about 30 feet. It should have been fairly clear to the instructor pilot, at least, that this was a very high and fast approach. The sound of the aircraft, of the wind coming by the aircraft, the noises you're hearing in the cockpit, much higher at 100 knots than it is at 60 knots. And the ground looks different when you're crossing the runway at 100 feet versus 30 feet. Again, this is something where, had it been myself flying alone or with an instructor, I would have said, I'm going to do a missed approach right now well before I get close to the ground, because the sooner you can get your aircraft reconfigured, get it into a stable condition, and then have a stabilized approach, the better.
So they didn't even have to get their speed up at 99 knots or whatever, no. Whatever the number is. That's flying speed. You know, pull the flaps up. They don't even have to go all the way up, but pull them up and go around.
And, you know, full disclosure, I had a tail skid strike once where I scratched the tail skid. Didn't have any damage to the aircraft, and there was no repairs. And this was a situation where I was landing to a full stop. Now, if I had done that and taken the aircraft off again, I would have made the assumption that if I heard anything that sounded like the tail hitting the ground, that I have some sort of structural issue that could lead to a flight control issue. I had to immediately get on the radio and tell air traffic control, look, I have a possible problem. I'm coming in for landing. I have a possible issue with the aircraft, just so they'll, you know, clear the area so I can land safely. I didn't see that happening according to the report. And this was not a little tail skid being hit. This was like a tail strike. And again, look at the video. You'll see a picture of the wrinkled fuselage in the back of that 172. So there's a lot going on here. And luckily, like I said, they're able to live to tell the tale. But this is a lesson to no matter where you are in the world, especially if you're flying a 172, you're going to have a similar performance in every part of the world because the airplane doesn't care. It cares about the condition of the atmosphere. It cares about, you know, how fast you're going when you touch down on the runway. But it really doesn't care about what country you're in, what language you're speaking, how much time you had flying. I mean, what was it? A few weeks ago, we did a show about a person who, the instructor, had 15,000 hours instructing in the Cessna 172. The student pilot, who apparently was training to meet the requirements for a commercial certification, had several hundred hours in the Cessna 172. And yet they put themselves in a position where they were doing a spiral dive or simulated spiral dive, where the requirements of the FAA do not require that you go all the way into it, but just that you recognize what it takes to get in that position. For whatever reason, they thought, let's go all the way and do the real thing. They spiraled all the way into the ground from, I don't know, 8,000 feet, and neither of them survived. So no matter what your experience, how good you think you are, even if you're very good, the airplane doesn't care.
You need to be very cautious, which I would say that the student pilot may have been more cautious than the instructor in this case. But the instructor just wasn't paying attention, wasn't home, wasn't hearing. There's a whole bunch of one-liners we use to describe this deficiency, this area that this flight instructor is deficient. But the bottom line is that he really wasn't engaged in doing the job that he was supposed to be doing. And as a result, he had a couple of opportunities to correct it before it happened, and he failed to do so. When he finally took action, it was a little too late, but not so late that he couldn't recover. But it was a little too late, and he had some damage, and he gets embarrassed on what happened. And he admitted some of it to the authorities when they questioned him. So that's to his credit, but it was kind of obvious what happened. So, it's a good lesson for everybody.
And we, threw around the term stabilized approach, or I did, a couple times. And this report actually takes an excerpt from the FAA's Airplane Flying Handbook. And I'll just read this for those of you who are listening to the audio version of this. FAA's Airplane Flying Handbook defines a stabilized approach as one in which the pilot establishes and maintains a constant angle glide path toward a predetermined point on the landing runway. It's based on the pilot's judgment of certain visual clues and depends on maintaining a constant final descent airspeed and configuration. Clearly that didn't happen here.
Bingo, right?
And it gives a little bit further information. It's stated for general aviation piston engine aircraft like the Cessna 172, an immediate go around should be initiated if an approach became unstable below 300 feet above the ground. The handbook lists the criteria for stabilized approach. These included airspeed criteria, airspeed within plus 10 and minus 5 knots of the recommended landing speed specified in the aircraft flight manual. I'm not going to pull out the Cessna 172 manual, but I'm sure, 100 knots or 90 knots, rather 100 feet off the ground is well in excess of that. 1.3 times the stalling speed on approved placard or marking speed. Now, the stalling speed for a Cessna 172 with full flaps is, again, I'm not quoting numbers exactly here. It's on the order of 50 some odd knots. If you're going 90 knots, that's well ahead of 1.3 times even 60 knots. So again, you don't have to know chapter and verse what the numbers are for a stabilized approach. You don't have to know chapter and verse exactly the numbers when you're flying. Sure, study this. You might have a written exam on it. That's great. But with experience, and not much experience, you'll be able to have clues beyond the numbers as to whether or not you're on a stabilized approach or not.
Yep, a lot of lessons learned here for both the student and the instructor. Thank God, no permanent injuries or fatal.
And
that's a good accident.
It's a good accident. I deliberately picked one where there was no more than a serious injury, and they had a full report and had a training flight. And this is a perfect example because we had some feedback from the crew of that aircraft, and that's vital. We get a bigger picture of what was said, what was decided in the cockpit, between the two people in the cockpit, what was said from air traffic control, how that figured into things. And my second to last word is fairly simple. I picked this accident out because I wanted to learn something for my current training. And my second to last word is, you can do the same thing. Trust me, there is ample number of reports, NTSB, the Canadians, Australians, the UK, in English, if English is your primary language, and many in French from the BEA in France. And for that matter, for the Canadians also do theirs dual language reports. If you want to learn from others who are flying something similar to what you're doing, from others who are doing something similar to what you're doing, go find a report, check it out. You might learn a thing or two.
I'll keep watching our podcast because we'll cover them. We're going to cover them all.
Yes, indeed.
I like the single engine ones because I like to see that the mistakes that I made are still being made, because many of these events that we talk about, I've made similar mistakes back in the day, so to speak. Although the airplane I flew was a lot more forgiving, low and slow. I didn't even have radios to deal with. So I had plenty of time to think about it, even though the field I flew from was pretty shot. So anyway, my last word is always, we still keep having a pre-flight accidents involving a lousy pre-flight. So when you're going to go flying, do a session of pre-planning at home or in the airport, hotel, or wherever you are. When you get to the airport, the last thing you should do is do that again to make sure nothing has changed. And you go up to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. I mean, it's just unbelievable how many poor pre-flights we see in reports. And you know that there's many, many more that never make the report, never make an accident, but something has happened. And when you get into the airplane and go on your way, put your head on a swivel, because there's a lot of airports that are way too busy today with a lot of inexperienced people trying to get the time in to get a career in aviation, which is a great time right now to do that. And please, after you get in the air, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.
Travel is great, but planning for travel can be time-consuming and difficult. That's where One Travel comes in. With One Travel, you'll find everything you need to book the perfect trip. Flights, hotels, cars, transportation, it's all right there. With One Travel, you can book online, via app, or even pick up the phone and talk to a travel advisor ready to help you make your selections. Visit onetravel.com/music or call 855-437-2154. Plan it, book it, live it. One Travel.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.